and welcome to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
And I'm Sebastian.
And this week we are talking about the intersection of race and masculinity. It's been a topic of conversation in a lot of articles recently, a lot of online media talking about it. You actually spotted Reddit earlier today that I think we'll talk about maybe at the end of the episode.
All right.
Which I thought was really cool. Definitely a conversation starter, that's for sure. Now, don't forget, you can join in the conversation. Tweet us at Talk Can Queer, or find us on Facebook, Talk Can Queer, or just message us on the website. We had somebody actually comment on our website that our misogyny episode had a disturbingly lack of women, even though we kind of put it out to the ether of the internet and asked, and a lot of female-identified folks got back to us. We weren't able to get any female guests.
Yeah, actually, didn't we schedule two people who, like, the day before were like, oh.
Yeah, we had a number of people scheduled. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes
and it was
happens.
Something like my foot just exploded into a thousand parts. I can't really make it. And you can't really say, oh, you should come in anyway. I don't remember exactly what it was, but I remember it was something that was like, yeah, maybe you should not come.
Yeah, somebody was very ill. That was it, yeah. Maybe not exploding foot, but they were very ill, yeah.
Although we're not ruling out exploding foot.
No, I know. I mean, you know, hopefully they're fine now. But I bring this up because you actually did an interview with the Men's Outreach Coordinator and the Ethnocultural Coordinator for the AIDS Committee of Ottawa. And unfortunately, the files got corrupted. So we're able to get some of it onto the website. So you can hear part of the interview, but we can't actually broadcast the interview here on the show.
I mean, we could, but you. If you're a diehard fan of our show, you're going to want to hear it. But if you just enjoy hearing us now and then you're
probably sweet, your sultry voice.
You're probably just as well not listening to the very, let's say, low quality.
Yeah, some of it was good, some of it wasn't, and it was. It's very unfortunate that the files got corrupted in the process. But in the meantime, we do have another interview that we did. I had a great time chatting with the Asian Community AIDS Society out of Toronto. They were a pleasure to chat with, and I'm so glad that they were able to speak to me. And
the whole organization?
Well, I mean, the conversation to get to the conversation was with many people.
Oh, okay.
But I had a great conversation with Ryan Tran, and I want to thank him for taking the time to speak with me earlier in the week.
Really, I was just trying to cue you up to introduce the guest.
Yeah, no, that's what I was doing. So we're actually going to jump to an interview with him. So this was the conversation we had earlier. Bearing in mind, we are talking about the intersection of race and masculinity. And we'll be back in the studio just after this. Hello and welcome. I'm actually joined here by Ryan from the Asian Community Aid Service. You are the MSM Sexual Health Coordinator there. Just for folks listening, do you want to quickly define what MSM is?
Yes. So MSM is short for Men Who Have Sex With Men. So it's a broader term where it can include queer, gay, bi, or straight identified men who still have sex with men.
Excellent. I just want to quickly make sure we have all the definitions out there. I think it's very important that everyone listening is on the same page as us folks here in the studio having this conversation. So one of the things that have come up in conversations with us in the past, we were talking about resiliency a couple of months ago, when I think the last time we spoke with ACAS, and this idea that we wanted to explore a little bit further, and hopefully you can kind of help us in this conversation to kind of get that exploration underway. We wanted to look at the intersection of race and masculinity, specifically around the gay, bi, lesbian community, probably more specifically the gay community. Is this intersection something that comes up a lot in your work?
Yes, very much. It will come up here and there within the gay Asian men community in terms like, so especially in the media and pop culture today. Most recently, we hear a lot about Steve Harvey's comments that Asian men aren't seen as aren't attractive or aren't as masculine. And we've seen this a lot throughout in the past, where representation in movies and TV for Asian men were seen as the sidekicks, nerdy, or always studying a lot, or even like to the point of being incapable of romantic feelings. So especially in the queer community, we see Asian men are stereotyped. These stereotypes can be seen as more feminine or more submissive in comparison to other races. And the way that these Asian men are seen and portrayed has affected our experiences of gay Asian men through dating, sex, and then in turn affects of self-esteem, confidence, and health as well.
So in what ways does it affect self-esteem and confidence?
So we see a lot of that specifically through dating and online apps. Mm. Because with online apps, it's very prevalent through profiles where you see people stating no Asians or preference as dating preferences. And when you're, as a gay Asian man, when you're exposed to that constantly, or you see that a lot more than others, it slowly starts to affect your self-esteem, your confidence. You start feeding into that idea that, oh, I'm not attractive just because I'm Asian. Again, ties in with the representation as well in movies and TV. And then when you're faced with that, you start to question other guys, whether they are into you. It becomes a hesitation to even message someone or approach another guy because you're constantly thinking, would he even be attracted to me at all because I'm Asian or not?
Does that set folks up to be taken advantage of in any way?
It can be, yes, definitely. Because so when you're hit a lot by, when you're feeling undesired, when your self-esteem is low, your confidence is low, you're more likely, when someone is interested in you, when a guy is finally interested in you, you're more likely to loosen up your choices. You're more likely to take riskier choices. Mm-hmm. And it's harder to say no when this guy asks to not use a condom or wants you to bottom, even when you're not a bottom. Mm-hmm. It's harder to say no because this feels like the only guy out of 100 guys that are interested in you.
So I think, I've mentioned on the show previously how this kind of relates maybe to the idea of capacity to consent. Most folks might imagine that, you know, it's a very level playing field. Everybody has the same kind of say in what happens. But maybe that isn't the case. Maybe for folks who fighting for scraps, for people who aren't racist, that certainly might change the game a little. Have you seen, is that a correct kind of summary, the idea that it affects the ability to negotiate consent?
Yes, very much so. It's a power dynamic that not many people realize or can have the words for to understand and recognize.
What can folks do to kind of mitigate that power dynamic? big question, eh?
Yeah, what can we do? That definitely ties into resiliency, empowerment, having the support of community, of other people who have faced similar experiences, how you can support each other. It really does help to share those experiences, knowing that other people have been through the same thing, have felt the same way. And that can be very empowering for one. On a bigger scale, systemically, or through activism, there could be more representation of Asian men being desirable. Mm-hmm. And being desirable, not confined to one particular look or body, where you can be desirable through being not just muscular you can be skinny or fat.
I want to get into that in just a couple of seconds. Now, I like the idea of building resiliency through shared experience. I think getting folks to talk to each other is such an important step and such an important tool for empowerment and kind of community building. I know that ACAST does a lot of community building in Toronto. I think you folks are phenomenal down there in terms of what you do. What about folks listening who maybe aren't in Toronto? How do you kind of build it? Are there online communities where you can kind of reach out? Or?
Yes. Okay. So what we do to build that community and empowerment with us, within the Asian community, one of the basic things we do is when we promote our events, when we have posters for our workshops and events, we like to showcase a lot of Asian men. We want to increase that representation. And so we've always featured images of Asian men. And not just of muscular body types, but of also fat, skinny, twinky. We want to represent all the different body types because that's what's there. We're not all muscular bodies. We have done a calendar for Asian men, again, representing different bodies, because it helps. It's very empowering to see someone with the same body type mm-hmm. out there, represented in your own skin.
I mean, I didn't know that you. I didn't know that you had made a calendar. I certainly will be looking to see if I can get hands on one of those. And I think there certainly might be, certainly, you know, in like Vancouver and out west, there are quite strong communities happening. So maybe what I'm picking up on is, if there are service providers or people hosting and running events, maybe changing up the representation of who's on the poster. We're based here in Ottawa, and during the Ottawa Pride Festival, there were, you know, we like to call them oily boys, the idea, you know, super muscular, glistening with oil on the front of every poster. And that isn't an entirely accurate picture of who the community is. What kind of impact does it have when the only two images that you kind of see where you're reflected is either super nerdy or super buff? Like, what kind of impact does that have?
So it's always hard to relate to when you don't see yourself represented. Especially, this is why we have our event posters that feature Asian men, because Asian men will only go to an event where they can see themselves. When we don't see ourselves represented, we feel excluded. It feels unwelcoming. It doesn't feel like, oh, then maybe I'm not allowed to be at this event, or maybe I won't find other people like me at this event because it's only featuring this particular oiled muscular body. Mm-hmm. And then again, that adds a barrier to finding community, to finding support in the LGBT community.
I think it certainly paints a picture. I mean, it can be very off-putting to go to things where the image you see on the posters is very much opposite of your own body and your own experience. So I can see how that would have quite a substantial impact.
I agree, yeah.
In what kind of ways does this present itself in terms of the health of Asian men?
So again, it goes back to the core of it is the self-esteem and confidence from dating preferences, seeing that discrimination online and in dating culture overall, where it affects your choices that you can make. When you're seen as undesirable, when you're seen as only being submissive or automatically assumed as the bottom, it again limits the choices that we can make because of the power dynamic, feeling helpless, feeling unable to make our own choices because other people already have these stereotypes of Asian men. So when you're meeting a guy, you're dating them, and then they turn out to be a top when you're also, you prefer to be a top. And this is only a guy that has been, a guy that's interested in you out of a bunch of people who have been rejecting you. Mm-hmm. Again, it goes into, again, negotiating consent.
So, yeah, I think what we can kind of, the folks listening can kind of imagine here is you have, you've finally found somebody to be with and everything's going well. And it finally gets down to, as we said a couple of weeks ago, touching the Ghiblis. And then you find that what they want of you is very different from what you would want. Now, we were talking about the capacity to negotiate the consent. And I kind of want to spell it out to our listeners here. If you don't feel as secure, and we talked about, you know, the idea of feeling helpless and having that imbalanced power dynamic, you know, does that lead to perhaps a higher risk of things like catching sexually transmitted or blood-borne infections, or like what's the end consequence of that?
So the risk is that you're more like, when your self-esteem is low, you're less likely to be able to communicate what your needs are. The power then is out of your hands because someone else is telling you they don't want to use a condom, or yet you're the one that has to bottom. Because this is the guy that is interested in you, you don't want to lose them. So you might be more likely to agree to these circumstances, or agree to the other person's desires when it doesn't necessarily match your own. So when, in terms of not being able to negotiate using a condom, then that definitely can lead to more risk of transmission of HIV and STIs.
Now, is this something that has come up a lot at the work that the Asian AIDS community does?
I hear about it a lot in the community, in the gay Asian men community. As for our work, how we address it, we would do workshops to talk about negotiation, to talk about consent, and also talk about making our choices less risky, or how do we make sex less risky for ourselves.
I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, it's very unfortunate that those steps have to be taken. I'm certain in an ideal world, we would just have that power balance would be shifted back the other way, and things would be even and much fairer. So it is very unfair that those steps have to be taken on that end. Is this something that maybe yourself have come across?
Lots of times. I think it's a very common experience for gay Asian men. From the get-go, like when you're, especially for myself, when I was newly coming out, your only exposure really before coming out and meeting other gay guys is porn, gay porn. And a lot of times in gay porn, Asian men are typically the bottom, especially when paired off with someone outside of their race. Asian men are typically the bottom. And when you're exposed to that, a lot of guys, that myself included and people I've met, have automatically assumed that they were a bottom and only a bottom. And I hear this a lot. And before having sex or trying it out, they assume they're a bottom. And then when they do end up bottoming, they continue trying to force themselves to try bottoming again and again, even if it wasn't as pleasurable as they thought. And this is very common from what I've heard in the gay Asian community.
I think it's very, very unfortunate that, from what I can tell, from even that very first moment when you perhaps feel comfortable in your own sexuality, you're bombarded by these images of what role perhaps is expected, and maybe not what role is fair. So I think that that is certainly something that we can do to improve in terms of representation. Have things improved? Are we seeing any kind of development, or is it still as dire as it was maybe 5 years ago?
Has improved. Yes, things have improved in a way, because of all these, like when we see a lot of comments from like again in pop. Popular culture, Steve Harvey has made comments, there's always been a pushback. Mm-hmm. And that tends to look like people will start being like, oh, Asian men are attractive. We have, look at all these photos of muscular bodies, of Asian muscular bodies. That means they're attractive, which is great in a way, but also problematic in itself.
Yeah, I was thinking, is that the problem then, that in order to perhaps fit Asian bodies into this Western beauty standard, we're kind of morphing them into a standard that is already quite problematic?
It is, yes, it is definitely problematic, because again, you're comparing yourself to just one norm, one social norm, that it does not encompass everybody. You're leaving out a group of people who don't have those type of bodies, or who are more feminine. And this idea that a muscular body is more attractive, leaves out all these other people.
I think that it reminds me, what you said reminds me of something that Tom Daly said. And he does videos to encourage different workout regimes. And Tom Daly is a multiple-time Olympic diving athlete. He has the epitome of a swimmer's body. But what he said was that his body is unbelievably unrealistic. I mean, he wakes up at 6 a.m. every day and works out for 10 out of the hours of the day. And he essentially said, you know what, don't aspire to be what I look like. Aspire to be, you know, maybe the best of what you want to look like. And I think that was a beautiful message. So it seems like some people are catching on that the idea of this perfect muscular, pumped up image may not be the best. I'm sure for some folks that is the identity and the body that they want to have, but trying to squeeze everybody into that box maybe isn't the best the best approach. That makes me actually think of another question. Are we seeing any rates of what doctors are calling bigorexia? So it's the addiction to muscle gain. Is that something that we're seeing in the Asian community?
I can't speak to any kind of research or studies like that or anything specific, but I do see, just from what I've seen in my experiences in the community here, the Asian community, that there's definitely a lot of pressure to buff up, to work out, to get those muscles. Yeah, especially in even like the circuit communities, at circuit parties, there's a lot, you're topless and there's a lot of different muscular bodies. It adds a lot of pressure to want to buff up.
Just for folks listening, do you want to quickly explain what happens at a circuit party?
Okay. So a circuit party, it's basically like club, like a gay club, but it's a lot of electronic music, EDM, and it can some they tend to be like multiple nights in a row. I've been to like a one or three night party, and it's just it's a huge room full of like thousands of gay men dancing topless.
Just having a very good time. Now these events carry a lot of significant in the gay community. They often have been in the 80s and 90s. I think they were a focal point for that, for where a lot of gay men would go and be in the same community together. So I can see why, you know, what you see at these events is certainly quite a powerful has a powerful impact. Are there any other ways that you can think of which we haven't quite addressed here, where race and the way masculinity is presented might be different or might express itself differently in the Asian community?
Let's see. So we touched on how Asians can tend to are stereotypically are seen as a bottom, can be undesirable because they're nerdy or have no emotions, romantic emotions at all in films. They can typically be seen as more feminine, I think, in comparison to Western norms. Asian men are seen as more feminine or submissive or weak.
Are they undermined as a result with that assumption? Is there kind of an undermining that happens in relationships and in other dynamics?
Yes, because again, in the idea that masculinity is more attractive, that leaves, if Asians are seen as not even masculine enough, that already puts Asians at the bottom. It feeds into the idea that being feminine is not desirable,
and I think attractive. And I think that calls back to our show a couple of weeks ago when we looked at misogyny. And kind of how that bubbles up in different ways. So the idea of femininity being not as desirable as masculinity. I think it certainly is interesting to see all the different ways that core concept is being demonstrated. So I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come and chat with me. And I hope that what we've managed to do is to give the folks listening perhaps a more of a in-depth kind of example and analysis of what the real consequences of that power imbalance.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. And for folks listening, how can they find out more about the Asian Community Aid Services?
So we have our website online. It's www.acas.org. And there's also a Facebook. You can search for Asian Community Aid Services.
Excellent. And I'm sure if they're not living in Toronto, you'll know the best ways to help them out where they are. So folks, feel free to reach out. And thank you so much for chatting. And we'll be back on the show just after this song. Thank you so much. Welcome back. That was Block Party with The Love Within. Now, Sebastian, you helped us to choose the music this week, and you kind of wanted to highlight openly gay POCs.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you also put a restriction on me that they had to be Canadian.
Well, of course, right? Then, community radio, Canadian radio. I mean, we have to support our own.
And then that made my brain stop because I couldn't think of any male Canadian openly queer POCs. That's mm-hmm. that's a lot of intersections going on at the same time. Even male identified, I mean, I should have said, which doesn't necessarily make it much easier. And if you can think of anyone, by the way,
yeah, we have a database going. Yeah, we have a database going of Canadian queer artists, and we try and you know, get as many names on there so that we have a big roster to pull from.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's always our aim, is to get more and more names on there to kind of have a diverse music selection.
Yeah,
absolutely. Next week, actually, I'm planning to play the new song. A collaboration by Buffy Sainte Marie and Tanya Dugac, and it is a phenomenal song. So now Buffy's new set of tracks coming out. Very excited. I'm not sure if either of them are queer. I feel like we looked into it in the past. I might just be a big fan and keep playing it. Or we looked into it and one of them was, and that's why we keep playing it. Either way, we keep playing these two artists because they are very good. And
you're probably going to want to edit this out if I'm grossly wrong, but I'm pretty sure Buffy Sainte Marie identifies as two-spirited.
Oh, okay.
Moderately sure, yeah.
Okay. Well, if we're incorrect, tweet us and let us know. We did look into it before, but I have the memory of a goldfish. We look into things every gosh damn week. So to keep all of that retained is a
my problem. Challenge. This is something that occurred to me some time ago. I have moved around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been to 4 universities. I've lived in 7 major cities. I've been on a first name basis, literally with a couple thousand people mm-hmm. over the course of my life. And so I forget names all the time because it's just being dumped into the big, big hole with all the other names out there. And I'm just staring at someone being like, oh man, I know I've known you for years. Even you, sometimes I stare at you.
Oh, I get your name wrong all the time.
Yeah.
I get you and Jake mixed up, which infuriates him, so that happens. Anyway, so some names that we're not going to forget is actually the ones that you interviewed earlier today. So now the folks that you are now on first name basis with. Now, David McMillan, who is now working for the AIDS Committee of Ottawa, way back when, so our longtime diehard fans may recognize him as the third gay on Three Gays in the Radio. Now, folks were like, what the heck is that? We were Three Gays in the Radio way, way back when. Then we rebranded as the Velvet Studio. And then just this past January, we rebranded as Canon Queer, really expanding the scope of our conversation to be about talking about big issues across the country.
Mm-hmm.
This is where... So David has come back into the fold in the conversation in his new role.
Yes.
And what did why was David in that conversation?
Because of the work that he does. Actually, should I isolate him or should I talk about David and Imad together?
Well, let's start with David.
Okay, we'll start with David. The work that the two of them do as a part of the AIDS Committee of Ottawa, there's a lot of outreach to be done. And he has been focusing a lot on the targeting issue of trying to approach men's issues in a way that is more likely to actually get hits, to actually, get people listening or get people asking for help. Or if you offer help, do it in a way where they're more likely to accept your help. That sort of general...
Somewhat like smart outreach as opposed to throwing things against the wall and seeing what sticks.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I'm pretty sure they do that as well, because I mean, that's the nature of Twitter. Twitter is you tweet a thing and you pray that the right people have managed to watch it that day.
In my case, that anyone has seen it. I mean, although I actually get pretty good Twitter feedback. So,
My favorite actual recent story that I've heard about Twitter is the Victoria Police on Vancouver Island in British Columbia have about 70% of the followership in Victoria. So if you have Twitter in Victoria, there's a 7 out of 10 chance that you follow the police. And the reason why is because they spend most of the day doing like hilarious jokes and bad dad jokes and, cute pictures of kitties and tiny little police officer uniforms. And everyone's like, oh, it's actually very brilliant because on the rare occasion when they have to put out an Amber Alert, everyone sees it. Mm-hmm. And so high quality Twitter with goofy stuff where you're not all about seriousness and professionalism, it turns out to actually have a thing. Completely unrelated to the ACO. Our other guest was Imad. So I was speaking earlier with Imad Khadi as well. Or at least that's how I think you pronounce the GH. Every language has a different way of pronouncing the GH.
Mm-hmm.
He is the... You said
ethnocultural
earlier,
outreach.
That's it, the ethnocultural outreach. His job is very similar to David McMillan's in the sense that he's targeting men in the community, but this time where it intersects with ethno-racial issues. So how do you do outreach to men who are not from a North American culture mm-hmm. of some variety, or even actually if they are from a North American culture in the sense that they're Indigenous or Inuit?
Yeah.
Or Métis. And they all have slightly different ways of being approached. And this is actually one of the things that came up in conversation about how men from different cultures react to needing or asking for help. Or if you ask them if they need help, how do they react to that? So some cultures, you're not allowed as a man to need help. You have to be independent all throughout your entire life. And others, it's acceptable to need help and to ask for help. And it all depends. And so this is, he kind of acts as an advisor, and he also participates with the outreach, trying to direct the outreach in a way that can get the right target and is done in a way that's sensitive to the sort of internalized view of masculinity mm-hmm. of the different cultures. I mean, you're interviewing me about my interview with them. So, I mean, this is my brain is, this is weird for me. This is a meta interview, it seems.
It is, absolutely. Yeah, it's very meta.
Yes.
We recommend that folks go to the website, www.canqueer.news, and you will see the interview there in full. It's a bit tinny, and, you know, the mic drops a couple of times where the files got corrupted. We had to clip out some bad bits. But
I thought you said the mic actually dropped.
No, like the sound.
Things were dropped onto the mic. I don't know if you could hear that.
What?
Yeah, okay, obviously didn't pick up on that, so it's not a problem. Anyway.
But I mean, unfortunately, the files got corrupted, so we are at a bit of a loss. But moving on, yeah, no, it was, from what I heard, it was a very interesting conversation. Absolutely, definitely well worth folks tuning in and giving it a listen to kind of explore this topic in a bit more depth. Absolutely. So earlier we mentioned that you'd sent me a link to a Reddit conversation.
Right.
And I thought that was actually really interesting. And it speaks a little bit to the conversation we had with Ryan earlier at the top of the hour around the intersection of race and sexuality. Now, can you kind of perhaps flesh out for the folks listening what this Reddit conversation is? And whilst you put your thoughts together, let me just explain to folks listening what Reddit is. It's essentially like a global comments board, and you kind of put the questions out there. It's like Yahoo. But
have we used Reddit on here before?
No, we haven't.
We've used Reddit. Whisper on many occasions.
We love using Whisper. So somebody put this big thing, this question out to Reddit, and essentially this gentleman said, you know, I'm a person of color, mm-hmm. and I've now decided that I'm just going to avoid dating white people.
Yes.
Because everyone is like, I want you and your BBC with me tonight, and I want you to dom and be a top. Now, for folks not familiar, I'm not referring to the British Broadcasting Corporation. It's a porn slang term for big black dick. And it's this assumption that all black men are dominant, that they're the active partner in sexual intercourse.
And they all have, let's say, tight underwear.
Yes, and
each of them.
Obviously, all well endowed. Yeah. I mean, universally well endowed.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like the racist assumptions. There's a lot of stereotype impact in there. So essentially, this guy was like, you know what? I'm kind of fed up with it. I'm going to walk away from that. You know, has anybody else had this experience? Or is it just me meeting some dicks?
And it's really interesting because he even goes on. Actually, I have the thing open now. I don't know if it'd be appropriate to read it out without his permission, though. So I'm just,
well, I feel like posting it publicly to the web is kind of...
Well, I mean, I'm going to summarize it anyway, just out of respect. But there are a few really good lines in here. So something that he's very concerned about as well as the portrayal of black men in American porn. I think he specifically said American because the way they do it in Europe, well, I mean, the way they do a lot of things in Europe is slightly different. And sometimes a slight difference you can get a lot of mileage out of that. It's largely split into two varieties. One is sort of horrible early 2000s thug rap inspired, like, black archetype who's mm-hmm. a thug and a gangster, and he's gonna hold down some tiny pretty white twink and do horrible things to
him. Absolutely.
Or There are some studios, this is what he says, there are some studios that are open to showing the roles reversed, where a black guy bottoms for a white guy, but it doesn't sell at all, and most of the studios learn that this is a Mandigo fantasy, and that's not really what white guys want. So he says, basically, like, the conversation goes on from there of...
And other folks kind of chip in and join in the conversation, and it's usually, I mean, it's anonymous. Insofar as you can make up any username you want, but
yeah, and it also it moves on, and there's all sorts of conversations about the portrayal of Hispanic men and what's wrong?
Nothing.
Oh, you're squinting like you're in pain.
I was doing math.
Yeah, I don't retract that statement. But yeah, it goes on from there, and lots of different perspectives about what all of this could possibly mean. And the general conclusion that a lot of people are saying is that if this is something you're running up against, mm-hmm. then maybe let's say take a break for a while off of all this. And
I think we're talking about like online dating apps, you know, where there is no filter really.
Well,
I mean,
yeah,
but filters, but that's not
what I mean by this is don't burn any calories on white guys, but, you know, don't rule them out either, because not everyone's equally horrible. And he was kind of like, yeah, sounds about right.
I think when I talked earlier with Ryan, I really want to kind of create some action items here. Let's find a way of taking what we're hearing, taking right. the lessons that's being learned, and what we're hearing from Ryan and David and Imad and the folks on Whisper and on Reddit.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of these people are saying the same things, where, you know, we're seeing effectively racism kind of coming out in these interpersonal relationships, where how they either internalize masculinity or how they're expected to display masculinity.
Right, yeah.
You know, oh, you're a black guy, so you have to be the dominant top. Like, that's how you're expected to be. And that's simply not accurate. It's not a universal rule. There are plenty of bottoms who are people of color. You know.
And yet, who's the most famous gay black man in the world right now? RuPaul.
I immediately went to 50 Cent.
What? He's not gay.
I heard that. Yeah, that's a good point. But I was thinking of a music festival, he's on the lineup. Anyway, moving on.
And if you look at the contribution, the historical contribution of gay black men to culture, mm-hmm. you get people like Little Richard. You get people in the ball scene who created voguing and who are still expanding the dance scene. You have people in the early bounce scene who gave us twerking, and I think they've done better than that, but you know, they did that thing, and they're a huge cultural impact, but a lot of them unfortunately never really get the spotlight. It's mm-hmm. somebody else who emulates them who gets the spotlight, unfortunately.
We were talking earlier at the top of the hour about representations in media. We were talking then about representations of Asian men,
yeah.
and kind of how you see two body types, the super nerdy or the super buff Asian man. Like, that's it, that's your two options. Take it or leave it. And we kind of see that in all of the POC communities, the people of color representations. You know, it's...
Oh, ultra mask or ultra femme.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's no middle ground. There's no...
Now, when I lived in Hong Kong, actually, there's some differences that I noticed. So Aaron Kwok, or Kwok Fook Sing, his actual Cantonese name, if you're familiar with Cantopop at all, he was really into sort of David Bowie-inspired glam. Mm-hmm. while I was living there, and it was sort of semi gender bending, kind of cross dressing sort of thing. So he would wear women's power suits.
Okay.
So like an Ellen's type of power suit. But on a man, it actually, even though it was all feminine clothing and he would wear blouses and everything, it looked incredibly masculine on him, even though yeah. he was sort of gender bending. And you don't really see depictions of that. But I was in China at the time. And so, of course, there's more diversity of depiction mm-hmm. of what it's like to be an Asian man when you're in China. But it doesn't really cross the big drink very often.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately.
And I think maybe that's something we need to take ownership of here. You were saying earlier about, you know, essentially with the advice of this guy was like, you know, maybe take a break.
Yeah.
And don't lump all white people together.
Somebody actually
else. There's a bit of onus here that some if you're a white guy and you're messaging people who are people of color being
yeah.
like, oh, you're an Asian, you must be a total bottom.
Yeah.
Or you're a black guy, you must be a top. I mean, let's just stop and think about that. And just think about how many stereotypes you're building into that.
Well, here's a follow-up question on that same thread. Question from a white guy. Have you ever noticed shibboleths? So do you know the term
not
shibboleth?
Not familiar, no.
Shibboleth is the, I believe, ancient Aramaic word for parsley.
What?
It's an ancient something word for parsley. Anyway, it's from a Bible story about how a bunch of people were trying to flee a country and the Romans were trying to pull out the Jews, and they would just pull out this piece of parsley and they say, "What is this?" And if they said shibboleth, they knew that they were Jewish. And if they said sibboleth, they knew that they weren't. And it was just a different in pronunciation.
Okay.
And so shibboleth is basically if you pronounce something in a specific way, it gives you away as being a whatever.
Okay.
And so it's also, you could have also used litmus test here. Like, what's the litmus test? But anyway, what is the shibboleth that gives away which white guys are cool and genuine in their interest and which ones have a sheltered worldview? And there's...
I like that. That's a very optimistic way of defining it.
Well, one of the things that came up after that was the idea that if they mention race at all, that's a bad sign.
Mm.
So it's sort of like if you're on a dating site and somebody says no drama. Okay. That is a sign that they probably cause drama, because anyone who's capable of navigating through life as an adult, when drama starts to come up, they diffuse it, they walk away, they refuse to participate. You know, an adult when
they recreate it in interpretive dance.
Well, that's a little bit more.
Niche.
Yeah. But the only people who are truly actually embroiled in drama, generally speaking, are people who cause it or enjoy it, or people who have been like trapped into it and just can't escape no matter how much of an adult they are. But generally speaking, anyone who complains about regularly being trapped in drama
are dramatic.
They're either causing it or perpetuating it, mm-hmm. because, you know, the rest of us can diffuse it. If somebody specifically mentions race, that's a bad sign. Even if they say specifically all races welcome, because it kind of implies that they might be a globetrotter. Globetrotter being somebody who, and I quote, wants to date one of everything. And date is actually not actually the word there. They want to have sex with one of everything. Mm-hmm. But then it also implies one of everything. Like, that's also kind of racist right there.
Yeah.
And so you might just be better off, like, first of all, if they say nothing at all, that's a moderately good sign. But the problem is that people who are completely and totally blind and oblivious also never mention race whatsoever. So in that case, you're more likely to come across white exceptionalism, which is basically just the idea that, you know, whites are just normal people and then everybody else is racial or ethnic, or everybody else is weird or strange. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like it's like white normativity, I guess, in a sense, which is not great, but it's, you don't go out of your way.
So how do you,
it's like, cut least out the wheat from
the, how do you get the wheat from the chaff then? You know, like, how do you navigate that? How do you find the good guys?
Well, Reddit's still trying to figure that. This conversation started this morning. Like, it was, the first post was this morning at around 10 a.m. local time.
I feel like this is a conversation that's been going on for a very long time.
For a very long time. And I don't think the answer is just going to come out of one thread on Reddit.
I think at the end of the day, there is certainly, you know, a lot of cultures have very different ways of dealing with this. And I think here, Canada's a melting pot. So we're trying to navigate all of those.
Even the French in Canada have a slightly different way. So last weekend, a friend of mine who actually is currently from Montreal spent the weekend spent an evening at my place. He had to get back to work the next day. He was just visiting. It was lovely to see him. But we were talking about the differences between sort of Anglo and French cultures. One of the things that came up, this is really subtle, but, you know, if you had a tiny apartment and you only had room for a living room or a dining room, would you rather have a comfy couch and eat dinner off the coffee table, or would you rather have a full dining room set and no sofa? And sort of the typical Anglo response is eat off the coffee table.
Mm.
And the typical French, actually the typical Latinate, because same thing in Spain and Portugal, France, Spain, Portugal, well, you'd rather have the dining room set and everybody just sits around there. And then you actually put the coffee maker on the table, so you're always there, and even after you're done eating, you don't leave the table, because that's sort of the French way. Mm. Really subtle things like that, but also how masculinity is expressed is a little bit different in Quebec. So something that a lot of people have noticed is that if you go over to Gatineau, for some reason there's this magical wormhole that happens where every single waiter in every single restaurant, I've asked around, people have said they have seen an exception once, But every single, or almost every single waiter in every single restaurant is the most gorgeous man you've seen that day. And it's just really bizarre. But part of that is the fact that taking care of your appearance is not considered to be vain or effeminate in French culture. It's just considered to be being an adult. And quite often you can spot the English speakers in a crowd just by how they're dressed. Hint number one, they might be wearing Lululemon or track pants while in public. Whereas in Quebec, they're like, you know, those are gym clothes for the gym. And you're currently in a restaurant, so maybe you should be wearing restaurant clothes, which do not include track pants or Lululemon.
Not that you're judging here.
Well, I mean, I am French, so I mean, so judging is just a part of my way. But another thing that sort of is very interesting is if you go to a restaurant, the waiters will call you mon beau when they take your order. So, you know, que veux-tu mon beau? So that actually literally means, what do you want? My handsome. So it's like saying, you know, what do you want, love? If you're in England, it's the exact same thing, except they say mon beau to men and they say ma belle to women. It is not considered to be a gay thing at all to refer to a stranger as handsome. It's just being charming and trying to get a better tip out. There's nothing sexualized about it. It doesn't make you a gay man.
So we're going to bring it back in here because we essentially diverted to talk about how different cultures are different. I think folks kind of get that and how masculinity is represented.
You know, getting a few examples is not
absolutely
not a bad idea.
So go to our website, www.canqueer.news. Check out the interview with Imagine David in full. It's definitely worth it. Please do.
And also, French people aren't racialized. So yeah.
That's why I wanted to loop it back. Yeah.
You should have just said that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, whatever.
All right.
I think that's about just about all we have time for today. I know you wanted to mention Norway, but I think we don't quite, but that's on the interview, so folks can look into
I that. Did talk about, I've been talking about Norway a lot lately. It just happens. But I've been talking about the Dutch even more.
Everybody likes the Dutch. not as much as folks have been talking about Sweden and what's not been happening in Sweden. But we're not going to get into that. That's for another day. We are talking about...
Is it zombie attacks?
No, it was... You don't read the news. Yeah, that's fine. Next week, we'll be talking to the Canadian Cancer Society and talking about how there are different rates on different... And essentially how LGBT folks, for some things, have higher rates of cancer and for some things don't. And kind of how we can take better care of ourselves and build community to fight this dreadful, dreadful disease. So we're looking forward to that conversation happening next week. But that's all we've got time for today. We are playing out with another Bloc Party song because we thought, you know what, in for a penny, in for a pound. And this is their track Ratchet. And we'll be back next week on Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. That's all for now. Tell me some, and tell your bitch to get off my shit.
I said, make it count.